Welcome back. This is David Wilner.
And Brandon Levy Sullivan.
You're listening to The Landmine Show, brought to you by FoundationStone.org. And we're here in the studio. We have a guest in studio with us today. Barnea, who are we talking with?
We're talking with Professor Aaron Dembski of Bar-Ilan University from the Department of Jewish History, and who is in charge of the Jewish Names Project as well, and a few other areas, who has just published a book, Yediat Sefer B'Yisrael Be'et Atika, which translates in English. The English title is Literacy in Ancient Israel. And it's going to change the landscape of the discussion. We're holding in a question of, when is our earliest record of writing and literacy in ancient Israel? And we're hearing now about the alphabetic revolution. And when I hear about the alphabetic revolution, it touches a very early chord in me. And I'm not kidding, really. I remember I was very excited by alphabet cereal. It was really very exciting.
You ought to post something about that.
Cute.
Alphabet cereal.
Okay. It was, because these were the letters, and was, I could have some contact with them and look at them.
Oktav Ivri.
Oktav Ivri cereal.
With that
cereal. Oh, it would be big.
It would be.
They'd eat it up.
The next big thing. Barnea. It always comes down to food.
That's right.
Your diet is affecting you.
Yes.
You look great.
Thank you. I weigh less now than I have in a decade. That's what the scale told me this morning.
Wow.
I looked at the number. I said, I haven't seen that number in a long time.
And you could probably read it now, even if the scale was Ugaritic.
I'm getting there.
So, Professor Dembski, welcome back. And we're talking about early forms of writing. And we went to break. We're talking about the earliest, I would say, evidence of literacy in the land of Israel. And we turn the mic back to you.
Two camps.
It's a little overwhelming, right? There's so much to say. We have as much time as you need.
We can joke, we can kibitz. If you need a filibuster, we're here.
There are two camps of scholars over the years, from 1930s down to the present. One saying that there is widespread literacy and the other one saying that there's very limited literacy. And if it's limited, it's professional literacy as well. The truth of the matter is that most of these statements were made on the basis of a few verses in the Bible, particularly the one about a nar. In the book of Judges, chapter 8. Well, I purposely said nar, because that already colors the meaning of what's going on. Now, a nar does mean a young man, a youth.
But it's used very flexibly in the Bible.
Not only flexibly, but it's used particularly for a official. And it's also found on inscriptions with that meaning. So that even if you look at the Bible story of Mephibosheth, who was brought before King David, and the master of his household was Na'aro Tziva. Tziva was his official, was his, major domo, so to speak. He had quite a few children, and wealth on his own. So that when we look at the nar in Sukkot, who is able to write down 77 names of the elders of the city of Sukkot.
It doesn't mean any stripling off the
that's
street.
That's right. Or someone coming from the cheder, as it was suggested by one person.
A young boy. This is
a young boy. But rather, it is an official of the town who is able to produce for Gideon all the responsible people, all the taxpayers of that city, so that we're looking at a very limited literacy. We're looking at a scribal literacy. But that passage, for me, has another message. In a sense, it shows us how the early tribal leaders, like Gideon, were recognizing the power of writing to record the names of his enemies or the people who were responsible. So Gideon is now gathering his information also in a literate form. So it does indicate early appreciation of writing
employing
by the period of the judges. and that is parallel to the Izbitsata document. So that when you're looking at the Izbitsata document, you're looking at a first grader who is writing his alphabet somewhere on the periphery, near the border, the Philistine border of Israel. So that what we can do is to try to appreciate both the biblical and the epigraphic evidence and try to bring it together critically and judiciously. Be that as it may, I would say that there is this early evidence for writing in Israel from the epigraphic point of view. As far as how many people could read and write, and here again, I stop short of what we find in scholarship today, where you do have these references to 3% or 5% or 10%. These seem to be pulled from the sleeve. There is no real method. There's no real means in antiquity. In fact, before the 19th century, before 200 years ago, when census were taken and people were asked to give what education they had, were they in, did they pass first grade or second grade, or could they write their name down for the census taker and indicate some basic form of literacy? None of this is available prior to the 1900s, the 1800s.
On my way here, the last thing which I did was I prepared a writing sample to be for the university to see if I have to take Hebrew or not. That's I'm being tested in that field today.
Right. You're lucky they didn't ask you to draw a tree.
Yes.
Right. So my contention is that you have to talk in broad terms of restricted literacy, scribal literacy, as in ancient Mesopotamia and Egypt, or a possibility of a literate society, of a broad-based literacy, which we find in Israel, to my estimation, at least from the 8th century BCE, at the time of the writing prophets who write to a general populace. Also in classical Greece from the 6th century on,
Before the Common Era,
BCE, the classical period, that these are early examples of the spread of literacy, and that really means the spread of literacy, where the book is more available and people are writing, and even the common folk, as we know in the Greek culture, where, at least in Athens, where there was a form of negative voting in the form of ostracism, where if the population did not want their local leader, they would have to gather some 10,000 ostrica sherds, and which they wrote the name of that leader, and then he was ostracized, and he was kicked out of office. So that, again, is turning to the populace, the general populace. Now, whether everybody could read and write is another question, but at least they're taking a medium of writing to express their democracy, to express their form of government.
I'd like to challenge the biblical part with two questions. One is, the prophet is speaking, and whether he or his students later wrote down the book, and so that's retained, you're talking to the people. And you see in synagogues all the time, people come and the rabbi is talking to them. They don't know the Hebrew. They can't read it. Maybe they can use an art scroll translation. Maybe they can't. But because it exists in the book, the teacher who's charged with retaining in the words can say, this is what Isaiah says. The same thing can be there also. There are times that you're going to come and we find this in ancient societies that regular times various edicts were read out, and I can follow that, but only a couple people have to know how to read it to be able to share it orally. I don't have proof from that, the fact that the prophet's words were written down, that everybody's reading what Jeremiah says. And the second question I have is something which I believe I heard in Chris Rolston's lecture that David knew when we went to, that there can be a difference in print exposure. Maybe I can't write letters myself, but I know Coca-Cola, and I recognize that, or I know enough to this is what's going on. And I watch in the post office in the old city regularly people coming in with bills, and they don't know what it says because it's not in their language, because it's in Hebrew, and whether it can be American Jews or it can be Arabs, but they're not sure.
No,
and
somebody, I have to say mea culpa. I got it. I had, when I first moved to Israel 25, 26 years ago, I didn't read the fine print on my bills. My Hebrew was, I would say, passable, but it was just too much of an effort to read the small print. And it didn't come easily, and it was work, and then the terms were technical, and I didn't know them.
Right, but you still went to pay. You had a basic, you knew what was coming at you. I'm saying that's a level of literacy.
When language and writing is not native to you, and we see this with signs also, with people driving on the roads, right? You miss it. You miss a tremendous amount when it's not part of the way you look at the world.
And you and I were challenged in Cyprus to know which way to go because of that, and thank God we stayed alive. Go ahead, Professor.
Okay, let me try to answer both questions. The first one, one of my premises is that the literary creativity in ancient Israel, as well as in the ancient Near East in general, was on two levels, one the oral level and the other one the written level. So that quite correctly, when a scribe wrote a letter which was dictated by the king and was sent to another scribe in another capital, he read that letter out loud to the king. And very often the letters begin with the term read out, so that you have the complementary aspects of reading and writing in literary composition, as well as in publication and preservation of the texts. In fact, the first evidence of literacy in the Bible is in the passage that after the fight, Moses leads the battle against the Amalekites. And so, Vayomer Hashem el Moshe, and God spoke to Moses, Ketov zot zikaron b'sefer, write it down for a memory for the future.
In a book.
Or in a stone, I would say. V'sim b'oznei Yehoshua, and communicate it and teach it orally to Joshua. So that if you look at these passages, and many like that in the Bible, you will find both an oral and a written combination of creativity, literary creativity. Now, regarding the question about the prophets, prophets are very interesting because the great prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, are called in Hebrew not only Nevi'im Achronim, the latter prophets, but are also called Nevi'ei HaKtav, the writing prophets. And it's their books that we have that are attributed to individuals. And as Yechezkel Kaufman showed in his monumental work, the prophetic books do reflect a certain historic situation and a life of the individual lives of the prophet. How much do we know about Ezekiel and the loss of his wife and the fact that Jeremiah was never married and Hosea's problems with his wife? All of these come up and become part of the prophecy itself. But get back to your point. How many of the people out there could read the texts? Well, first of all, the prophets are making their presentation orally, just as the professor at the university makes his presentation in class orally, just as the poet reads his poetry orally, but yet sells his book of poetry at the end of the session, at the end of the meeting, so that we have this combination going on all the time. The question is, how many people out there could read the text? And we don't know, because Isaiah himself says there is a Sefer Chatum and the Sefer Patuach. There's a book that's closed. It's a closed book or it's an open book. And what we find is that people weren't embarrassed by being illiterate in antiquity. So this is a problem, and I'm not talking about interlinguistics, different languages, use of different languages.
That's true.
But to get back to what we're saying here, how many people out there could understand Jeremiah? Well, let me give you an example. chapter 26 of Jeremiah, where he speaks about the coming of the enemy from the north, the northern countries. And he lists the different countries, and he says, Melech Sheshach, and the king Sheshach, or of Sheshach, or the land of Sheshach, will come and destroy you. Now, everybody standing there says, well, wait, what did he say? There is, in our geographic knowledge, there is no country called Sheshach, Shin Shin Kaf. And then somebody realized, wait a second, the prophet is toying with us. The prophet is awakening us to the message. He doesn't mean Sheshach. He means Bavel, Bet Bet Lamed. He means the Babylonian king. And how do we know that? Because in first grade, after we learned the alphabet according to its order, we then divided the alphabet into its two halves and transposed the first letter with the last letter, the Aleph with the Taf, the second letter with the 21st letter, the Bet,
with the Shin.
With the Shin, and we produced the Atbash exercise. Now, if you follow Atbash, when Jeremiah is saying Sheshach, he's referring to Babylon. And he does that as a pedagogic device to bring his audience into his prophecy, assuming that they at least had first grade knowledge and could follow his drift. Not only that, but in the 51st chapter, when he speaks about the Babylonians specifically, and then mentions Lev Kamai, Lamed Bet Kuf Mem Yud, again, no such place. But if you apply the Atbash formula, you see he's referring to the Chaldonians, to the Kasdim. So in answer to your question, and there are other examples the same going on there, the prophets are assuming that outside in the urban audience that they're meeting at the entrance to the temple or on the streets of Jerusalem, that many, many people will understand the message of what they want to say. So that this is what we see in the prophetic books, and I use those books as a criterion for measuring popular literacy. And while I do not take a position where I will say there's 10% or 15% or 100% literacy, I would not make that statement, because that is an irresponsible statement. You can't give percentages nor numbers of how many people were literate. You could just indicate that that this is going on and there's an impact.
The text
of
is making a working assumption that there's literacy. That's the
right.
Premise of
That's
the text.
Right. Now, the second question that you raise, what about seeing words and understanding words just by the
being
sight?
In a world of words.
Yeah. Being in the world of words. Now, well, there's a prime example of that in the Lamelech seals.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Lamelech seals, which you know quite well, you'll see a design, right, which is
an eagle.
Well, no, that's a discussion. Well, there's a two-winged disc. And there's
a two-winged, either scroll or a four-wing scarab.
Right, and one can be Egyptian and one can be Assyrian. This
right,
is under discussion
right,
now.
Right, it's under discussion, and it could be various things because you're dealing with a design, you're dealing with a sign,
an emblem,
a symbol,
an insignia
an emblem.
That represents
right.
that everybody's supposed
and
to
everybody
recognize.
Can, it's not as objective. It can be subjective, and it can change also in a period of time, even a short period of time. So what did the royal authority do? It's used that symbol. They inscribed on these seals, Lamelech, this belongs to the king. So in other words, you didn't have to have a deep understanding of writing or wide spread of literacy. All you had to do was recognize that in this case, the emblem indicated a royal pot, a royal product, a royal message, and that was indicated by the sense of Lamelech. So all you had to do was recognize those four words or that design, and you were reading already a sign or a group of words.
Would have an impact. But maybe that, too, was handled only by administration, not by the common man.
Okay, but then you had all of the porters who had to carry these pots and deliver them. It's not only the administrators.
Print exposure. Everybody's seeing it.
And the soldiers, and if it's going to the front lines or whatever the theory may be at present, where these pots of wine are going, or the vintners who have put them into the jars and labeled them, in a sense, had to have some sort of recognition of these words.
I like that. According to Professor Oded Lipschitz and his team, it includes a few scholars, he wants to suggest that when Ahaz goes to meet the king of Assyria in Damascus, that means he becomes a vassal empire. And that from that time, that kickstarts the need to produce elements for taxes. And that the Lamelech jug handles and their successions and the private seals and the concentric seals actually take place for many, many decades before the destruction of the temple and over a period of time, not as was previously contended, I think by David Ushishkin, but don't hold me to it, that it was only under duress and suddenly when preparing for battle with an expected Assyrian onslaught in the time of Sennacherib and Hezekiah. It's a longer process. Assuming that is both theories would support what you're doing, because if I'm all of a sudden producing this and I don't know letters, like, what difference does that make? So it's also taking the premise that somebody's going to recognize what's coming, or at least take it out. But if it's used over a longer period of time, that means over a longer period of print exposure. Mm-hmm. You introduce, I think that you said this here, that the conversation has been recently, I've got archaeological finds, and I have a few people, not even 20 in the world, I would say, maybe I'm wrong, maybe it's 50, who are capable of extrapolating information and drawing historical conclusions because they are able to interpret the paleography and talk about the development. We must be talking where there's a cursive writing. We must have talking where there's a changing materials. Because I'm going to recognize what its origins is. Orly Goldwasser now saying the early writing is coming from the Sinai, disagreeing with others that saying it's coming from Phoenicia, that's where the conversation is. I've got a corpus of X amount of material, which, thank God, every year a couple more heavy hitters come out. We know there's two or three that haven't been publicized yet. But you're still dealing with something that a student can master.
We're going to have to ask you to hold that thought. We're about to go
to the
break.
Oh, boy,
that's
going to be tough.
We're talking with Professor Aaron Dembski. This is David Wilner.
And Brandon Levy Sullivan.
You're listening to Landmine, brought to you by Foundation Stone.